All right, this is one of the most amazing passages of the Bible, but I feel like it's kind of been hijacked. It's become a battleground for controversy, and it's been asked to prove things that which it has no desire to prove. And we've tried to test it against scientific methods, and we've argued long and hard for and against different interpretations, and I believe that very often we have missed the whole point. And we're easily drawn into controversy as we read Genesis 1, while missing the glorious and life-changing message that is sitting there waiting for us. Now, this passage has always brought interpretive difficulties. Most modern people, as they read this, they struggle to understand how the 6 days of creation and wondering how it could have happened so quickly. Just 6 days? It doesn't make any sense. But it's interesting that until the 19th century, but prior to that, people struggled to understand this passage for the opposite reason. John Calvin talked about how he encountered skepticism regarding the biblical account of Genesis 1 because in Genesis 1 it took God so long to create. Genesis 1 in his day seemed unbelievable because everyone knew that God could have created instantaneously if he so desired. So how long it took and made it hard to really accept that this was literal and true. And so people wrestled with it for a very different reason than why we wrestle with it today. But whatever struggles are present in the text, whatever questions are left unanswered, and I promise I will leave many of them unanswered, we come back to this important passage with expectation because we know that what we believe about the origins of the world will significantly shape how we relate to it. And everyone has a cosmology. Everyone has a belief, a theory of how the world began. And that cosmology significantly shapes the way we look at the world, the way we relate to the world, the way we think about life. And so today we look closely at the story of God creating. And first what I want to do is I want to walk through it quickly and make some observations. And then we're going to stop and we're going to look at a number of kind of big picture observations about what this means and doesn't mean. Okay? So let's first move through it, starting in verse 3. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So we see that God speaks, and it is so. It's through his powerful creative word through which the world is created. Now, we would commonly, as we think about this passage, say that this passage is about creation. We could have titled this creation, this message. But I don't think that's quite correct, because in Genesis 1, there's only one subject, and that subject is God. All else is object. Genesis 1 is not about creation, per se, but is about the Creator, who creates. And so through this account, what we're primarily being introduced to is the God who creates. He is the subject of the passage. He is the subject of each paragraph and almost all of the sentences, in fact. It's some 35, I think last week I said, some 35 times Elohim, God, is mentioned in this first chapter alone. And then, so God creates. And this creative act is then seen by God, and he says and observes, declares that it is good. God is the one who declares that this is good. His creation is good because he himself is good. His goodness is reflected in what he makes. And then God names the light and the darkness. And in naming, he shows authority over them. Just as parents name their children and not the other way around, God names the elements of his creation at each stage and as an act of leadership and authority. And then later, God is going to invite Adam into this role and allow him to name the animals. And then Adam is going to go and name his wife. And so this has significance. We'll look at it further as we get to those passages. Then verse 6. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning, the second day. So on the second day of creation, God creates this expanse, this atmosphere, separating the seas from the source of rain above. And on day two, it's interesting, there's no declaration that this is good at this point. And that's probably because that this phase of creation isn't completed until God then separates not just seas from sea, but then sea from land. And then he's going to declare that all of that is good. So we're going to see that next. Verse 9. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to its own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning the third day. Now on the third day, dry land is spoken into existence, and there's now distinction between land and water, and he names them earth and sea, and they're declared to be good. And then he speaks plant life and trees and vegetation into existence. The earth is now fruitful and productive and life-giving. And it sounds so simple, right? And it's so and easy. And it just sounds like this is not a big deal. But it really is amazing. We don't want to skip this too quickly because it really is amazing. The earth sits on an axis of 23 degrees, the tilt of 23 degrees, which is what gives us changing seasons each year. If the tilt of the earth were any greater, or if our orbit took us any further from the sun, our planet would be uninhabitable and would not be able to sustain any vegetation. If the moon were just a little bit, a small percentage closer, the tides of the earth, or the tides of the ocean, would cover the land every day. We have to realize the amazing detail, precision, the perfection that is required to design our planet in such a way that it can sustain life. It is remarkable that trees can grow on the earth. And God sees it, and he declares it to be good. Verse 14, and God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Now on the fourth day, we make a transition here from forming spheres, spaces, to filling those spaces, those spheres. The first thing we see, God's creating lights in the sky, namely the sun, the moon, and the stars. Now this is really significant for ancient readers, because in the ancient Near East, the sun and the moon are primary gods who rule over us. They are to be worshipped and to be served. Now remember, Genesis was written by Moses for the Israelites as they came out of slavery in Egypt and just before they entered the Promised Land. And Egypt, the primary god, the god that they would have grown up hearing about and knowing about and learning about, was the god Ra, who is the sun god. And he's the primary deity in the Egyptian understanding of the world, in Egyptian religion. There was also gods of the night and the stars and gods of the moon. But here they are nameless objects created by a sovereign creator god, designed by him to serve humanity. See, in pagan religion, we worship and serve the sun, the moon, and the stars. But in the Bible, God created the sun and the moon and the stars to serve us. Their purpose is to tell us the signs and the seasons. They're our calendar. They help us know the time. And they help us to give, it says, to give light on the earth. God creates the sun, moon, and the stars to serve us. And then their further purpose, we're told in Psalm 19, verse 1, is to declare the glory of God and to proclaim his handiwork. And so both, we see that instead of us living to serve them, they actually exist for us and for God's glory. And then in ancient days, as well as in our own time, people have looked to the stars to direct our destinies. People have believed that the stars can guide us and tell us the future. But here we see that the stars are a beautiful part of God's good creation. He's the sovereign who stands behind the stars. Psalm 147:4 says, he determines the number of the stars. He gives to all of them their names. So don't look for the stars to guide you. Look to the sovereign one who created each star and called it by name. Verse 20, And God said, let the water swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. So now on day five, God speaks and the waters and the air just explode with life. And they are blessed of God and told to be fruitful and to multiply, to fill the sea, to fill the skies. Again, ancient Near Eastern mythologies and religions worship the monsters and the creatures of the sea and the sky. But here, all living creatures in the depths of the sea and across the skies are created by God and for God. He stands sovereign and supreme over them all. They are objects of His creation, and they too are declared to be good. Verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. We'll skip down to verse 31 after the creation of mankind, which we'll read next week. And God saw everything that He had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. All right. So first on the sixth day, first thing, God creates the animals, creates the livestock, to creeping things, the insect life, to wild animals, the beasts. And it's interesting, the fish and the birds receive a blessing from God, but the animals don't. Instead, mankind is blessed and given dominion over them. So it seems that the fish and the birds are blessed to multiply in their spheres because they don't pose any threat because they're a different sphere than where we live. But on the sphere of the land, it is humanity who is blessed and given dominion and told to multiply. So we see the pattern and the order that is there. And then the passage we skipped over, that God creates humankind in an act that follows the regular pattern of the passage and yet stands out in some significant ways as well, which we'll look at closely next week. And then in verse 31, upon finishing His creation and the creation of humankind, God sees all that He has made and declares that it is very good. Now, in the Hebrew mind, there's no word for perfect. This is actually the strongest statement you can make about the goodness of the world. It is very good. It is perfect. Now, there's this really clear pattern in this passage as we think about and we look over the whole passage. There's 6 days and there's 8 scenes that happen in the same sequential structure. There's an announcement, God said. There's a command, let there be light, whatever. And there's a report, and God made it, and God separated, however it goes, what He did. There's a naming on the first 3 days that God called and named something. Later, we're going to learn that Adam is naming the animals, so God leaves that for him on the latter days. There's an evaluation. God saw that it was good. And then there's this temporal time framework, evening and morning and the first day and onward. So there's the same pattern. There's a rhythm to it. Furthermore, the 6 days divide perfectly into 2 sets of 3. The first 3 days, God forms realms of habitation, light and darkness, sky and sea, and land with vegetation. And then on the second 3 days, God fills those realms. He puts sun, moon, and stars to fill the heavens. He puts birds and fish in the sea and the sky, and animals and humanity to fill the land. In verse 2, we were told that the earth was tohu wabohu. Remember? A lot of fun to say. Favorite new word, tohu wabohu. It was without form, and it was void or unfilled. And on the first 3 days, God forms the unformed, creating spaces for habitation. And then on the next 3 days, God fills those newly formed spaces, inhabiting those spheres. So he corrects the tohu wabohu, the unformed and unfilled, and He forms it and He fills it. And then the inhabitants of the second three triads, the set, rule over the corresponding spheres that they are given. So there's this beautiful, poetic, orderly quality to the account. Everything is extremely purposeful. And there's this extreme rhythm and sequence to everything. Now, inevitably, questions then arise about science, evolution, and Genesis 1. Even a quick reading over the passage should lead us, is this repeated refrain about a day, referring to like a 24-hour day? Does that really mean that, or what does that mean? Now, after all, a day is measured by the alternating sun and the moon, but these aren't even created until the fourth day. So how do we know the first day is a day without a sun and moon to tell us it's a day? But the references to morning and evening seem to suggest a normal day. But perhaps the style and genre of Genesis 1 suggest to us that we aren't meant to read these as normal days, but as simply God correlating his work and rest with our work and rest. So it's more about the pattern than about the timing. And then, of course, there's the seventh day, the day that God rests, which carries on to today. God is still in a state of rest from his creative work. So in one sense, as we read day seven, it kind of carries on, right? And Hebrews suggests that and reads it as God is still in the state of rest, and someday we will live in a state of rest. And so if the seventh day carries on to today, is that the way to read that? And how does that have implications for how we read the other days? So perhaps the 6 days of creation are telling us more about the nature of the world and its order than the timing of its beginning. I quote Gordon Wenham, Old Testament scholar, says, properly understood, Genesis justifies the scientific experience of unity and order in nature. The six-day schema is but one of several means employed in this chapter to stress the system and order that has been built into creation. Then Old Testament scholar Tremper Longman writes, it appears that Genesis itself is not interested in giving us a clear and unambiguous understanding of the nature of the creation days. This ambiguity fits in with the overall impression we get of the passage, that it is not concerned to tell us the process of creation. Rather, it is intent on simply celebrating and asserting the fact that God is creator. So, now, in an attempt to reconcile Genesis 1 with modern theories of the age of the earth and modern cosmologies, there has been many proposals put forth. Some have suggested that the days of creation aren't days in our way of counting, but are days to God, which could mean any amount of time. Who knows, right? What's a day to God? Others have suggested that the days are literal 24-hour days, but are separated by indefinite periods. So 6 literal days, but not 6 consecutive days. So he does a day, and then like a billion years passes, or whatever. Others have suggested that gaps of millions or billions of years occur between verse 1 and verse 2. So you could have a young earth made out of really old materials. So the matter is billions of years old, but the earth was created in 6 days more recently. Others have suggested a young earth that was created with old properties, much like how Adam was created as a full-grown adult. God created an aged earth, right? If you were to walk up to Adam in the garden, you'd be like, he would look like, you know, maybe a 30 or 40-year-old man, and you would ask him how old he was, and he'd say, 6 days, and you'd be very confused because he looks much older than he is. Perhaps that same thing is true of the earth. You would be on an earth that is, 3 weeks old, and you'd ask it how old it was, and it responded for some reason and told you, it's only, 2 weeks old or whatever, but it looks like it's billions of years old. Who knows? And on it goes. The possibilities are many. The theories and proposals are many. However it was made, whatever processes or whatever time it took, what's important to believe is what Genesis 1 emphasizes, which is that God's creation was created orderly, intentionally, and by design. And all of those points stand in sharp contrast to the ancient cosmologies of Israel's neighbors, who argued that the world is chaotic, it is not good but evil, and was created accidentally. And so this is not an accidental world we live in. Everything in it points to a designer. The passage, I would say, seems to have very little interest in telling us how God created, aside from saying that he created by his powerful word. Instead, the passage is far more interested in emphasizing who created and what he created. But people want to know, does science disprove Christianity? It's important to understand, as we think about that question, the purpose of a scientific book versus the purpose of Genesis 1 and 2. And they're really quite different. So while we affirm that Genesis 1 and 2 is true in what it says, we need to read them in a way that is appropriate with its intention and genre. The Old Testament, the way it teaches and teaches truth about God, is in human language and in the forms of the time and place in which it is written. And Bruce Waltke says it this way: the Bible did not drop down out of heaven with the worldview of the 21st century any more than it originally came to us wearing the heavenly garb of the King James Version. The Bible originates not only in an ancient Near Eastern language, but also in the garb of the ancient Near Eastern literature. In contrast to scientific literature, ancient Near Eastern cosmologies describe the universe according to phenomenal language from a geocentric viewpoint, not with mathematical precision from a detached point of view from outside the cosmos. Okay, so the key word there is the word phenomenal, which has two definitions. The more common one that we use means like amazing, right? Or extraordinary, remarkable. This is a phenomenal sermon, right? Stuff like that. That's not what Waltke means by the word phenomenal. There's a second definition, which is a little more rare. It's more of a philosophical definition, which means perceivable by the senses and immediate experience. In other words, through your senses, through your experience, if something's phenomenal, something that you see, you can smell it and see it and taste it, and it's through your own experience that you encounter it. And Genesis describes creation and this act of creation through phenomenal language from a geocentric viewpoint. In other words, it's not written from a scientific perspective. It's not written from out in space, a third kind of objective view. It's not written from a mathematical perspective. It's not even written from God's perspective. But it is using the language of the senses and our normal experiences. Now, we do this all the time. We talk about sunrises and sunsets, though the sun does no such thing, right? It does not rise. It does not set. We spin, right? It seems to rise from our perspective. So speaking from a phenomenal perspective, we talk about sunrises and sunsets. That's how it seems from our viewpoint, from our vantage point. It's normal to talk about the sunrise, though technically, scientifically, it's completely incorrect. The sun does no such thing. We also talk about the sky being blue. The sky, technically, scientifically, is not blue at all. It is violet. It appears to us to be blue because during the daytime, human vision is 8 times more sensitive to blue light than it is to violet light. So it looks blue to us from our perspective. Phenomenally speaking, experientially speaking, we see the sky and it looks blue. Not the case. So are we wrong every time we say that, what a beautiful blue sky? No. It's just looking at it from our vantage point rather than a scientific vantage point. And this is what the creation account does. It is written from our vantage point, not from a scientific, objective, out-in-space perspective. So our language reflects our common experience. The Bible speaks this way as well, from our perspective, from our experience. So it makes sense to our life in ways that we understand. And more specifically, it's written from the perspective of the ancient Israelites and the people of the ancient Near East. That doesn't make it incorrect in what it affirms. It's just a picture, in fact, of our loving God who stoops down and communicates in our way, in our language, in our terms. Also, while scientific literature, the genre of scientific literature, is obsessed with the question of how, the Bible is primarily concerned with the question of who. An example from outside Genesis might be helpful. In Psalm 139, verse 13, a very well-known passage, David writes and says, he writes of God saying, "You knit me together in my mother's womb." Let's think about that. We could say David was wrong and the Bible can't be trusted. David wasn't knit together with like knitting needles by the hands of God. He wasn't created by divine knitting. What silliness. David was created by his parents and their sexual relationship, right? You know, is David denying that? Is David unaware of how his parents ended up with him? Does he need? I think he figures it out eventually. Is he denying that his pre-born body, his fetus, grew through normal growth patterns, you know, a fetus nourished by a placenta? Is he denying that all this happened? Not at all. What David is doing is celebrating that God is the ultimate cause of his life. He's celebrating that God is the ultimate creator. And David is ignoring all the means and methods, all the scientific ways in which God actually did create him. All the secondary processes are completely ignored. David is not making scientific claims about how he grew in his womb, in his mother's womb. He's making theological claims about who is the sovereign God who stands behind all these things, including the very normal biological processes. So David can call his ultimate source God while ignoring all the processes that God uses. That's what he means when he talks about God knitting him together in his mother's womb. So the same could be said, I believe, of Genesis 1 and 2. These chapters aren't really interested in telling us scientifically, mathematically how, but is very adamant about who. They are repeatedly and forcefully insisting that God, the God of Israel, the God of the Bible, is the sovereign and sole creator of the universe and all that is within it, while largely ignoring the processes and methods by which he used along the way. I like the way J.I. Packer puts it. He says this: Genesis 1 and 2, however, tell us who without giving many answers about how. Some today may think this is a defect, but in the long perspective of history, our present-day scientific preoccupation with how rather than who looks very odd in itself. Rather than criticize these chapters for not feeding our secular interest, we should take from them a needed rebuke for our perverse passion for knowing nature without regard for what matters most, namely knowing nature's creator. The message of these two chapters is this: you've seen the sea, the sky, sun, moon, and stars. You've watched the birds and the fish. You've observed the landscape, the vegetation, the animals, the insects, all the big things and all the little things together. You've marveled at the wonderful complexity of human beings with all their powers and skills and the deep feelings of fascination, attraction, and affection that men and women arouse in each other. Fantastic, isn't it? Well, now meet the one who is behind it all. As if to say, now that you have enjoyed these works of art, you must shake hands with the artist. Since you were thrilled by the music, we will introduce you to the composer. It was to show us the creator rather than the creation, and to teach us knowledge of God rather than physical science, that Genesis 1 and 2, along with other celebrations such as Psalm 104 and Job 38 to 41, were written, he says. So do science and Genesis 1 and 2 conflict? Well, if you insist that Genesis 1 and 2 are trying to give us a technical, scientific accounting of our origins, there will be many conflicts. But when you come to see that Genesis 1 and 2 has a very different purpose and is answering a very different question, the conflicts quickly disappear. So then we must ask, well, what then is the purpose? What then is the purpose of Genesis chapter 1? The first purpose is establishing who. The God of Israel, the God of the Bible, is the creator of all things. That is why, primarily, we have been given this passage. It doesn't tell us as much as we would like about how, but we have utter certainty about who, because creation points to a designer, a creator. Kent Hughes relays this story. It's said that Isaac Newton had a mechanical replica of the solar system that he built. It had a giant golden ball in the center, and it was there, and then he had all the different planets in the appropriate dimensions, and it had they had posts and gears and everything, so they actually rotated, and there was like this, they were in their proper orbits. Quite an amazing thing, and everything was rotating and built properly in perspective. And one day an unbelieving friend came and visited Newton, and seeing the model exclaimed, "My Newton, what an exquisite thing! Who made that for you?" Without looking up, Sir Isaac Newton replied, "Nobody." "Nobody?" his friend asked. "That's right, I said nobody. All of these balls and cogs and bells and gears just happened to come together, and wonder of wonders, by chance, they began revolving in their set orbits with perfect timing." See, the existence of Newton's machine points clearly, obviously, to a designer, and so much more so does the existence of our Earth and our beautifully ordered solar system. So the creation account, like creation itself, is proclaiming there is a single sovereign creator. The second purpose of this passage establishes what. What is the nature of creation? What is this that he has created? And I think that here three points emerge as to what is creation. First, the world was made good and not evil. Which may seem obvious, but this is in sharp contrast to the viewpoint of most of the ancient, or all of the ancient religions of Israel's neighbors. So unlike the ancient myths who believed that the world was created evil, the obvious and significant point of Genesis 1 is the goodness of what God has made. God is preeminently the one who is good, and His goodness is reflected in His good creation and what He has made. So any evil, any sin, any suffering, any death is a later interjection, a corruption of God's good creation. So this is very significant. This is very important for us to get, that God's creation is good and sin and evil have corrupted it. God did not create an evil world. Now, today many people believe that the world is by nature evil. This is the belief of Buddhism, which the physical is evil, the earth is evil, and what's good is the spirit, the soul. So the goal is to escape this place, to achieve nothingness, to get out of here, because it's an evil place to live. Also, many today believe that the world is by nature immoral. It's neither good nor evil, because it's not designed good or bad, and because good and bad are simply our categories. We just made those terms up to make judgments on things. Since the world as we know it is just a product of time and chance, there is no good or evil by nature. So it's nothing. It just is. To which the testimony of Scripture is that God's creation is by nature good and glorious and life-giving, because it reflects a good and glorious God. Evil and suffering and death are corruptions of this world, distortions. They show a good world that is a broken world. And we see that God is at work. The testimony of the Bible is that God is at work undoing this corruption, restoring His good creation back to paradise, and He's doing it through His Son. So the world is created good and not evil. The world is designed and made beautiful. It's not evolving through unintended, unguided processes. It is a glorious and beautiful creation which reflects a glorious and beautiful Creator. It was designed beautifully and is not just what we got, come what may, through unguided processes, but was designed and made beautiful. We see that. And thirdly, the world was made purposefully, orderly, and structured. It's not made chaotic and accidentally, which was the belief of the ancients, that the world was created through chaos and conflict and is a disordered, accidental, chaotic place. But the obvious truth of Genesis 1, as we look at the structure and the rhythm and the pattern and the poetry of it, is that there's purpose and design and order and intentionality in the world and to life itself. We are not the victims of chance nor of capricious and selfish gods, but are the creation of a designer living in a world that is created, designed for our flourishing and our life. And so this is a very significant and orderly and structured place we live in. Now, this being true, what does that mean for us? How should we live? What should we do? And I would say two things. One is there's a reaction, a response we need to have in relation to God, and there's a response we need to have in relation to the world that we find ourselves in. This being true, in relation to God as Creator, we must worship. We must worship God. H. Conrad Heyer writes, "What Genesis 1 is undertaking and accomplishing is a radical and sweeping affirmation of monotheism vis-a-vis polytheism, syncretism, and idolatry. Each day of creation dismisses an additional cluster of deities. On the first day, the gods of light and darkness are dismissed. On the second day, the gods of sky and sea. On the third day, earth gods and gods of vegetation. On the fourth day, sun, moon, and star gods. The fifth and sixth day take away any associations with divinity from the animal kingdom. And finally, human existence too is emptied of any intrinsic deity, while at the same time all human beings, from the greatest to the least, not just pharaohs and kings and heroes, are granted a divine likeness and mediation." See, because God is Creator, God alone is Creator, He is deserving of all our worship and our praise. Romans 1:20 tells us that God's invisible attributes and His divine nature are made visible through His creation so that everyone sees and has a sense of God. It is pointing us and telling us of a divine creator. Psalm 19:1 tells us that the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies above proclaim His handiwork. That all creation is constantly speaking, constantly preaching a message, constantly pointing us to a creator, proclaiming His goodness, proclaiming the beauty of the one who designed such beauty, designed this such order and glory. Revelation 4:11 tells us that God is worthy to receive glory and honor and power because He created all things and they exist by Him. And so all of our life must end. The end game for life is worship. We must join in the song of creation in proclaiming and enjoying and magnifying God. The appropriate end game of science is a heart full of awe at the Creator. That's why we do science, to glorify God, to worship Him, to discover He is more intricate, more beautiful, more orderly, and more glorious than we ever imagined. And so we look off into the deep depths of outer space so we can see a God who is more glorious than we ever knew. As He put all these extra bonus stars just for fun to show us a big and glorious picture of how glorious He is. And we're going to keep exploring and seeing new things as a picture that God has given us of His glory and His majesty. That He is far greater than we'll ever explore, and His glory is far more massive than any telescope can capture. And so He gave us a space so that we could see it and marvel at it and be filled with awe. Secondly, in relation to our creation, in relation to God we must worship. In relation to creation we must steward the earth. We must care for it. We'll get into this a little more next week when we talk about the image of God. But we need to reject a Platonic view of the world that sees the spiritual as good and the physical as evil. Right? This is not biblical. This is Plato. This is Greek philosophy. It's not from the Bible. It says that the spiritual is good, physical is evil. That's not true. The earth was created good. It was declared good and is good. We don't treat it as garbage. We don't exploit it and abuse it. We don't destroy it. We're called to care for it and steward it and tend it and work it and develop it. We also need to, though, reject a pagan view of the world that worships creation, confusing creator with creation, and ignores the creator while worshiping what He has made and turning created things into gods. Because God alone is worthy of worship, and His creation points us to Him, but is not Him. And as we gaze at a beautiful mountain, our hearts should be filled with awe and with worship, not resting on the mountain, but on the creator of the mountain. And humans are not just one equal part of God's creation, standing on the same plane as insects and cattle and whatever else, but are set apart as unique. We are given this unique role to care for God's world and to have dominion over it and to steward it and tend it and care for it. And so in relation to the world around us, we need to neither worship creation nor destroy creation, but to tend it and care for it in a way that leads us to worship God even more. And so a beautiful, ordered, glorious, and good creation is actively, constantly pointing us to a beautiful, powerful, glorious, and good God. And a beautiful, ordered, glorious, and good creation invites us into the song of worship that His world has been singing from in the beginning. Father God, we thank You for who You are, the Creator of all things. We do not live in a chaotic world where no one is in control and there's no guidance. But we live in an ordered, beautiful, glorious world. You are the Sovereign One. I pray that You would give us eyes to see the beauty and glory of Yourself as reflected in the world You've made, and lead us into worship. Lead us into worship and into the praise of Your name. Recognizing that You've created all things for Your glory, for our good, for the proclamation of Your name. May You be glorified in Your world as our hearts worship You. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.